the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Week, episode 129, recorded Saturday, February 8th, 2014. Huddling in the White House.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
AV Week.
Online.
This is AV Week. This is AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. Good afternoon. My name is Tim Albright. I'm your host. Welcome. With us this week is George Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage. And at this point in my relationship with him, the entirety of my brain. How are you, sir?
That doesn't bode well for either one
no,
of us.
No, it does not.
Good Saturday to you all.
Good Saturday. Also with us, Heather has been on before. Her name is Heather Sidorowitz. Last time she was with us, she had a different title, but this time she is the president of Southtown Audio Video. Look at you go.
Look at me go. Hello, all.
Congratulations, ma'am.
Thank you.
If you're on Twitter and the Heather Sidorowitz part doesn't sound familiar, she's known as Tech Chi. Which is how she introduced herself to me at Infocom last year. So, welcome, ma'am. Also with us is Josh Shirago. Josh, he works for ICS as a project manager. He also does a lot of stuff with the Red Band and Chris Nettos and the guys over there. And this week, he's a thorn in Gary Kay's side. So, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. It's been a very, very busy week. I think I had 4 articles circulating on 4 different sites. So,
dude.
Yeah, it's been nuts.
Well, at least you're busy, you know, at least you're keeping busy. So, and last but not least, my favorite doctor in the whole wide world. It's the only time I'll call you doctor, hopefully. Dr. Yoram Solomon, Vice President of Corporate Strategy for PennView. How are you, sir?
I'm good. And did I mention that I spent half the night in jail?
Why did you spend half the night in jail, Yoram?
Okay, not that exciting, but I went on a police ride-along and with Plano's finest, and we got into an incident, and we apprehended, well, I sat in the car, but we apprehended suspects, we took them to jail, and then for 3 hours they did paperwork.
That's for future reference, you did it single-handedly.
Yes!
Yes.
Gun no, was drawn.
I played with the air conditioner.
Just for the record, that's how Breaking Bad started, if you guys remember correctly. You know,
that's right.
You know, it was
right along.
Yeah, it was a ride along. Walter White was riding along, saw his former student jumping out of a meth lab, and said, I can do this. Mm. Yeah, not that, you know, anyhow. This week, we're going to talk about a whole lot of stuff. First of all, the man that just spent the night in jail also hung out with the country's CIO, and we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about some integration stuff, some installation technology that is changing and kind of rearranging. There's a stretchable liquid metal for pulling, you know, that pulls cable and some other stuff. Biamp has some new products that are AVB specific, and Chrome, or specifically Google, is trying to get into the huddle spaces. But first, something that actually Heather sent down early this morning, and we're going to talk about Sony's PC business. Is Dio is dead? Sorry, guys. I still have a Vio that I program on, but this is kind of sad. And according to Wired, their TVs are next, which we're showing a very...
That's crazy.
Very old TV. Heather, since you sent this one down, how big of a deal is this? I mean, is this... Do you think maybe this is Sony's just cutting the dead weight, or is this a significant shift?
You know, I feel it's a shift. I feel like that it's an old boyfriend re-breaking up with me. you know, Sony, it's just that name that's been out there for so long, and we all know it. It's a feel-good name. Mm-hmm. Everyone is either owned or owns a Sony TV. I remember learning that pointless trivia knowledge, Vio is video audio integrated operations. For no good reason do I know that.
So congratulations there.
See, there you go, right? Pointless knowledge. And the TV side just, I have to say, it hurts me a little bit should their TVs go away.
Josh, when it comes to Sony, they have been around for an awful long time in the broadcast field. But here's the thing. This is a company that has an awful lot of silos. And I've said this before on this broadcast and written about it. They have so many arms. They have so many different verticals that they could probably do to cut away some of them and maybe focus on stuff like, I don't know, movies and music and other technologies. So is this a big deal?
Not really. To be perfectly honest, I mean, I used to work for a guy who used to work for Sony, and as he took over the company, the manufacturer I was working for, it was a perpetual story of, when I was at Sony, this is how we did
seriously?
Things. Oh, seriously. And what made it better every time was that his division didn't exist anymore. So clearly they were successful in what they were doing.
So he was in the Walkman division.
Oh, clearly. But... you know, it's, I mean, they've been chopping away. Go back and look at some of their wireless microphone technology. They had amazing wireless microphones, and those are gone. You look at everything else that they're getting rid of, and you start to look at where they're investing a lot of their money, and a lot of it is in the PS4. I mean, they're going to war right now with Microsoft trying to take over the home. That's where they're trying to invest their money right now, and rightfully so, because Microsoft's Xbox One is... you know, that's a battle to be fought, and there's only one other player. So why not, you know, chop off some of the dying limbs and put the money elsewhere?
No. But don't you think that the TVs are so much of the core of who they are?
Well, and I see definitely that where you're coming from, because that was, you know, Sony. Say, let's take it back to the 70s, you know, 40 years ago. Sony was the home, right? If you were anybody and you had, you know, any sort of technical prowess to you. You had a Sony TV, and you had a Sony, Betamax actually at the time, but you had Sony products. You had a Walkman, you had this, that, and the other. And so I can definitely see, you know, it is kind of sad. It's a passing of the guard, I guess.
Well, there's an interesting side to it. Sony used to be, if you go back really a long time, Sony was an innovator. Sony was where you found things for the first time. That's where the transistor radio came from, the Walkman, and the boombox. They came from Sony. And the thing is, I read a book once that talked about product strategy for high-tech companies, and he talked about vectors of differentiation. And the thing is, if you can be an innovator, you can take a certain route, but you have to continue and innovate along this route. And once you decide that you're going to now work on improving the value or the quality, Sony became, from an innovator, it became a quality company. So you got Sony products because they were high quality, they were in Taiwanese, they were made in Japan, the quality was better, the quality control was better, but that is not sustainable. And that's, I think, what we're seeing in some of their businesses.
So do you think they've lost their innovation, or they've lost that quality control?
I think the quality control is pretty high. I think they lost their innovation.
Yeah, that is kind of sad.
Yeah, I have to agree. It was. I mean, I get the feeling that this is sort of like that Monty Python skit when he walks into the pet shop. This is an ex-parrot.
Yep.
it really has come to that degree with them, and we've talked endlessly, almost ad nauseum, as it were, about how they just keep missing the mark, from the way back to the DAT machine to not seeing what was coming with the tape and the CDs going away.
They got Blu-ray.
Oh, what?
right on the cusp of physical media going away.
Yes.
Oh, and let's
may or may not want it.
And let's look right at that. I mean, you talk about them addressing Blu-ray right as we move to 4K, which is the only kind of display they're still talking about making.
It's true.
Okay, so here's a stupid question. I don't know if it's a stupid question, and I understand the basics of Blu-ray and 1080p and the different formats there. Can Blu-ray not sustain or not reproduce 4K? Is that what we're saying? Is that even not possible?
Not as a hard medium.
Okay. Because that was one thing.
There's not enough data on the disc in order to put.
It's 50 gigs for crying out loud.
Well, no, but aren't there?
And it's still not enough.
Well, weren't there? There were some forms of it that had like the four layer, you know, the different levels that would go through. I thought that could do some of it, but you wouldn't get very much. I know they were chasing that at least 2 or 3 years ago. But the truth is, regardless of whether it can do it or not, it's about streaming. And people aren't buying physical media, except for maybe vinyl, but that's sort of a nostalgia thing. I doubt you're going to have very many people doing a nostalgia buy for Blu-ray.
Oh, no, you watch. They're going to be doing a nostalgia buy for Laserdisc. And then Sony will be back. buying
right on top, baby.
Yeah,
on eBay.
On eBay, nice.
They were gonna rule eBay.
Actually, here's a stupid aside. About a month ago, I had to do I had to convert from HD DVD to Blu-ray, and I had to go on eBay, and it cost $300 to buy an old DVD player, an old HD DVD player, because that was the format that it was made in. So yeah,
still $300.
Still $300. Well, originally they were like $600 or $1,000.
Supply and demand.
Uh huh. All right, from our buddies over at CE Pro, Legrand is acquiring. I'm going to butcher this, so I'm just going to say it. Laystar. And C2G, which for those of us who used to buy from C2G, it also used to be called Cables to Go. The skinny on this, guys, is the fact that Legrand is picking them up. The details were not, you know, available, I guess. But they should completely integrate everything in the next month or two. So basically, by Infocom, Legrand will have themselves a bright, shiny new partner. The first question, and Yoram, we'll start with you on this. Was this a good move? I mean, was this, you know, what changes, was it a good move from Legrand? And then what changes should we expect in either Legrand or in C2G as a result of this purchase?
Well, I have to admit, I don't know enough about neither one of those businesses. I think the weird thing is, the question is, what did they buy? What did they get? I mean, is it a commitment to move everything to optical? Is it, are you buying the last buggy whip company that's out there? That's the question. What was the plan? What's behind it?
Yeah. Yeah, Josh, who do you think benefits most out of this? Is it Legrand? Is it Quicktron, which is another company that is a part of the purchase? Or is it C2G, or is it the customers in general?
To be perfectly honest, I'm a little confused as to what they're going to do with this whole thing in general. I mean, I get the fact that Legrand has a lot of the floor boxes and the racks and all those little pieces and components that go into it. And now the big part of this for me, coming from the integrator side, is I saw Cables to Go in this, so C2G. Yeah. And it's like, okay, so great. Now I get to call you, and there's my floor box, there's my rack, and oh, hey, give me all these patch cables. So if they're going to put themselves in a position where they can now say, tell us what your interconnectivity is, and we will ship you the complete package of rack, floor box, and all the interconnective cables. Hey, that's kind of cool. I can't see them doing that based on the way that Cables to Go has always functioned.
Well, and you make a good point, because the Cables to Go has kind of functioned as a wholly owned little. I mean, let's be honest. You can go straight to Cables to Go. It's not a distributor model. It's not a vendor model. You know, you don't have to have a Cables to Go or a C2G dealership to sell that. You know, you go straight to the website. So, Heather, when it comes to this deal, I mean, who do you think benefits the most out of this?
I don't know who benefits the most. I don't know. This one didn't strike me as a, you know, there's no Nest Google acquisition.
No.
No.
Not $3 billion.
No. It just struck me more as a, they're just filling out to become, you know, that maybe a larger monster of different pieces of that pie to put together. Maybe they're aligning to be, I don't want to say Snap AV, but that kind of site where, you know, that you can buy one, get it all there, get all the different pieces together. Yeah, it's not, it didn't strike me as a huge change to the industry, but maybe I'm wrong.
All right, George, Heather, and Josh have both mentioned the fact that this is possibly, you know, a get it all here, one SKU or one stop shop for integrators and for end users alike. Is that a valid, you know, take on this?
I think so. I think you're still seeing a consolidation from the recession. The independents or those who could stand alone are starting to say, well, those who aren't so strong on their feet, we need to consolidate and maybe try to become a one-stop. I think this is also the monoprice effect. Mm. Monoprice is getting into a lot of stuff, and it's the dirty little secret for a lot of installer and live event companies, I might mention, where we get cables from. You know, we're no longer building our own. Part of the article talked about the biggest seller is going towards pre-terminated cables. Now, for a staging or live event company, you get that. It's just less expensive to have someone pre-terminate them than try to have a field of guys who, you know, in the old days, you all started off in those companies as soldering, right? And making XLR cables or crimping BNC. Which I find fascinating and might actually be a dovetail into Heather's article in, about being born of a certain age and learning some skills.
Generation Awesome.
Generation Awesome. Dude. But I really do think it's the monoprice effect that we need to get this, that we are so tight for our margins and so tight for time in a lot of things that we are looking towards either an integrator houses coming together to supply stuff or it's monoprice.
I didn't think about the whole monoprice effect, but yeah, you're probably right. All right, guys, moving on. The ISE, the Integrated System Europe show, was this week. And one of the more interesting things, at least for the whole AVB / HD-based T debate, was Tessera. Tessera is a line made by Biamp. And, well, they came out with a new one. And this is something that has been cooking for a while, obviously, because they had actual product and they have it on their website. It's called the Forte, Tessera Forte. And it is, as the article in Installation International says, it is AVB for application-specific settings. In the mind of the integrator, read Biamp Nexia, folks. And the reason I mention that is because the Nexia, for Biamp's point of view, was one of their, and still one of their more popular lines. And if you think about it, if you're not familiar with it, basically it's an all-in-one fixed configuration, and we'll bring up a picture here for those of you watching the video. It's a fixed configuration audio processor, DSP. It's specific because you can buy them for video conferencing, you can with AEC built in, you can buy them for regular audio conferencing, and this, that, and the other. Here's why it's significant, though, in the fact that you've got Biamp taking AVB one step further, and they're doing it with this fixed configuration, this Nexia type layout. To me, it's significant. To me, it's them taking it one step further. George, first question for you, though. Is this the right move for Biamp to make, to put so many chips, as it were, in the AVB slot?
It's really hedging your bets, isn't it? Look, they included Dante in it, so yeah. Where does that leave AVB? You know, they're supposed to be, at one point we had someone on one of our shows who was talking about how they were going to be merging and it would become one standard. I'm not so sure that's happening. And I think they're hedging their bets and saying, here's a machine that will consolidate them all. Now, I don't know if anyone else has had the opportunity to look at the box. I certainly haven't. My wonderment is, what happens when you go from AVB to Dante or to any other protocol they say they're changing between? Is there loss? Are there certain considerations to have? I'd love to hear more about that. But again, my main point is that, including Dante, this is a step towards trying to make a common protocol. But I think you're going to see Dante win.
The only thing I don't have experience doing Dante. I have experience doing CobraNet with it, and that's pretty seamless. It really is. That's with the Tessera server, so that's the big mamma jamma. Obviously, with this fixed configuration, I don't have any experience because they just released it this week. So. Heather, is this the right move for Biamp to go down the AVB route or to push more and down this AVB?
You know, I'm not super familiar with Biamp. It's not a product that I've done a lot with. So I'm going to refrain from this one.
That's all right. I appreciate it. Mr. Strago, you are one of the main audio guys on this. Kick it off here, brother. Is this a good move for Biamp to be putting, you know, this big of a bet on AVB?
Here's the thing. While the AVB release is very important, it's the Dan 1 card that was more important.
Okay.
Because the Dan 1 card gave them a 64x64 Dante matrix capability up through the server. What they've done is said, okay, we're going to give you AVB because we've already got AVB built into the Tessera. And now we're going to give you Dante capability on top of that. Whereas Dante is basically hedging its bets with everyone with the release of the news that, oh, hey, we're going to incorporate AES 67 standard. We've already got AVB, which has IEEE standards. Yeah. So Dante is playing every market possible, saying, okay, where do you want to go? We're going to cover you. What Biamp's doing right here is perfect for what they wanted to do with the Tessera and the perfect next step for what they want to do. Because they built that giant server, and now, as you said, they were really popular with the Nexia system, and now they can kill that damn thing, finally. Because now they've
built it with fire.
Well, now they've built a box that can replace it, and on top of that, it can be built into an already existing Tessera system by networking it via AVB, or you can start small and then incorporate into a larger system via AVB. So they've given themselves the ability to go in either direction of growth via AVB, but also given themselves the ability to go Dante very quickly with the change of a card. So they've really given themselves some flexibility to grow and move here, while still providing the ability of growth to eliminate a product that should have died 5 years ago.
Well, it's interesting you said that, because I'm starting a project with it. It's a nightclub, which I've never done before, so this will be interesting. And there's a lot of different zones and stuff, this, that, and the other, and we're looking at different products, and I happen to like Biamp a lot. I've got a lot of experience with it. And I made the comment, I said, well, you know, it's dollars for dollars and processing and this, that, and the other, it's actually cheaper to do a Tessera than it is to do an AudioFlex, which, if you're not familiar, those are both big multi-rack unit devices. But the Tessera simply has twice as much power, twice as much processing power out of the box that the Flex does. And actually, one of the questions I was going to ask, that Josh, you brought up, you think then that this is going to kill the Nexia line. Will it also kill the audio line for Biamp?
No, this won't kill the audio line, because they're still going to need that medium-sized product, and the audio line still has the capability. So what you're going to get is all those small meeting rooms, all the huddle rooms, because this is only going to give you, what is it, a 12x8 matrix, I believe. Yeah. And you know, when you start to get into a system that small, you need capability of growth, and that's where the AudioFlex is going to come into play for them. And so they're going to have the ability to go really small room to a server for the super large installations to the really small installations with the Tessera server capabilities, or you can go to the isolated systems, which is where the AudioFlex, because don't forget, in addition to the AudioFlex, they still have the AudioSolos.
Yeah, that's true.
So with the AudioSolos, you still have the fixed configuration of isolated units. So you might start to see the AudioSolos lose popularity depending on where they price these things, but typically speaking, the Nexia system has been, it's outdated at this point. If I see it in a scope, I throw that thing out faster than you can spit. Like, I get that thing the hell out of there. I don't want anything to do with it anymore, because there's nowhere to go with it. You can't expand on it. It's going to go live in a rack for 2 years and die.
Hence the term fixed configuration. So, all right, Yoram, we'll let you chab on this for a second. When it comes to this technology, AVB and Dante and all these different audio protocols, is this, do you think, maybe looking at it from a 50,000 foot view, is this the right move for Biamp to go down as a company, to put so much stock into AVB, or like George said, you know, they're hedging their bets with putting Dante in there?
Well, like Heather, I don't know enough about this, but unlike Heather, it doesn't stop me from talking about it.
I like the cut of your cloth, man. Yes, I love the indeed. Cut of your cloth.
But I think, you know, especially I'll touch on one aspect of it, and this is the multi-protocol. And it was kind of funny, because earlier this week I did meet with the Plano police chief to talk about systems that they have for surveillance. So I know it's different. But one of the biggest complaints that he had is that you have a lot of source, and then this applies to the AVB market as well. You have a lot of different sources from a lot of different protocols, and what you're trying to do is assure interoperability, transparency, ubiquity of the content. And so when you're trying to hedge your bet on a protocol, whether it's Dante or any other, I think it makes a lot of sense to use whatever processing power you have to assure interoperability, so you can accept any type of protocol and send it to any other protocol network.
Yeah, and that makes sense. That, well, it does make sense. That was one of the impressive things about this, the Tessera server.
Right.
Now, I don't know, again, haven't touched this box yet. I'll try to get my hands on it in the next couple months, depending on when they start shipping it. But the server, the interoperability was really, really, really impressive. So, all right, you are listening to AV Week. That gentleman right there is George Tucker. He's from World Stage. Heather Sidorowitz, the brand spanking new president of Southtown Audio Video. Look at you go. Josh Strago, project manager for ICS, and the proverbial thorn in Gary K's side this week. At least you replaced me. And from Solomon from Penview. Moving on, folks, let's talk about Google for a second, or Chrome specifically. CNET put up an article that says Chrome's next target is your meeting room. Bum, bum, bum. And I immediately thought of all the huddle spaces that all of us are putting in, whether that it's in someone's home or in the office or what have you. Yoram, we'll kick it off with you on this. When it comes to just the idea of, I don't know, can Google do this? I mean, can Google actually pull off a polished product to take over video conferencing and the interactivity that we have in our different meeting rooms?
Let me start with what are we using for today's call? We're using a Google product, and we're using
it.
We're using it in a commercial application. You know, I'm coming from a company that for 34 years before I joined was a telecom company where we knew everything about 99.999, the five nines. We're not in a five nines world anymore. We're in a world of integration. We're in a world of different types of content. Look at how good a quality of a call do we have? Do we have 99.999? We do not. So I think that I like what they did. I like that new system. They should. They are rightfully going into the teleconferencing area. I think with the right product. I think with the right price point, which is critical. I like that comment about remembering a 20-digit number. I'll tell you something. I do a lot of presentations internationally, and it's hard. I learned that if you want to start up, and I'm sorry, hope this is, I'm still going to be invited, but I'm using WebEx and I'm using GoToMeeting, and I know that for the first 15 minutes, what we're going to do is make sure that everybody is on and that it works and that we can share things and all, and there you have it, a tool that is much cheaper that I believe would just work great.
Yeah, absolutely. Josh, can you can Google do this? Can they pull this off either in the residential or in the commercial world?
Definitely in the commercial world. I work in Silicon Valley, so I can't tell you how many times I hear people say, "Oh yeah, we're just going to throw an Apple TV in there to handle all of our presentations."
That explains your great tan.
Oh yeah, pasty everywhere. That's why we grow the beards, so that we don't have to have color.
Is that why hipsters grow beards? Okay,
it is. So basically, when I saw this coming out, the other day, it was very much, oh crap! Now what little thing am I going to have to install for all the little huddle rooms and little meeting rooms? And then, as Yoram just pointed out, there was the 20-digit comment, and I just sat there and I went, thank you, Google, for now making us have to convince everyone in the teleconferencing unit that this is not going to be sufficient for something larger than a 10 by 10 foot room.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is Google is selling itself through Hangouts, through Google Plus, through Google Chrome as this interactive product that's going to be cross-platform, your mobile device, your home devices, and now in your tablets and everything else. And they're going to make it easy for you. They're going to make everything easy for you. And you'll just have to rely on them. Only they're not talking about the fact that they can only work to a certain level. So because people are so familiar with the brand, they're going to go, oh, well, I can use that in my home. I mean, I compare it to the Bose effect of, I have this in my home. That means I can use it in my house of worship. That means I can use it in my commercial space. That means I can use it in my Starbucks, wherever you want to. But it's that Bose effect of, we've made it so easy for you that suddenly now you can use it everywhere, only you can't. So they're going to be successful with it, and it's going to piss off a lot of integrators in the process.
Tell me how you really feel, brother.
I'm going to make a lot of money trying to fix these systems.
That's what's going to happen. Heather, actually, I want to take it to you, to the home. Is this something where Google can make inroads in the business place, in the business market, and transfer that to the home market I telecommute 2 or 3 days out of the week, so that would be nice to be able to have face-to-face meetings with folks from my house, but I don't know if they can pull that one off. Do you think they can pull it off and get people to do video conferencing from the house with the Chrome?
You know, we talked about earlier about how, with Sony and how they had so many different silos, and Google, you just have to, I would love to be there to wonder which silo are they focusing on today?
Yeah.
Obviously, we just had that huge purchase with Nest that says that Google is committed, at least it says to me, that Google is committed to the home and the Internet of Things and where we're going in that direction. My favorite line of that article was, the company needed to solve its own teleconferencing problems. And that's it, is that we keep running into these glitches. Technology is just not a perfect science. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't all have jobs. But I want it to work. I think that Google has definitely potential. I've never done a Google Hangout before like we are today, and it was incredibly simple. And there was a new feature that you two didn't even, you know, you discovered today. Hey, this feature now exists. Yeah. It's just there. So the ability to do that already on an infrastructure that already exists says that they have the ability to do it. To take over, probably not. To find a niche in the market, I think so.
Yeah. And that's probably the better question, is whether or not, you know, they can get, you know, some sort of market share. Heather mentioned something. We started doing video, the video version of AV Week back in October, I believe. George, correct me if I'm wrong on that.
I believe, yeah, just about.
Heather's right. She mentioned the fact that we discovered a new tool today. It's a tool called Uber Conference. You can bring people's audio in only by giving them a phone number, and they can join your Hangout like that. I will say this about the Hangout specifically. That's obviously what we have experience doing. Almost every week or every other week, there is some new feature. 6 months ago when we started this, we didn't have the thing called Control Room. And now on Google Hangouts, you have something called Control Room. I could literally change the volume of every single person on this call, including my own. You know, 6 months ago, we didn't have that. It was all or nothing, right? I could mute all of you, or I can mute you, or unmute all of you. Now I could change the volume of everybody, right? Same thing with the video. I can, you know, select different videos and stuff like that. So almost every couple of weeks, they're doing something, and this costs nothing, right? So that's the danger of it.
And they did it in a really good interface as well.
Yes.
So yeah. It was easy to use. It wasn't, you didn't have to be techie or nerdy or, you know, to use it. But you want, you know, I had a moment of panic, like, oh my, will I be able to click the right button? But it was easy. And that's the advantage that they have on this conference side, is to get the right interface and to make it that simple.
Yeah.
Well, and the one thing that I haven't heard anybody mention yet, which is the fact that Google's giving itself a recurring revenue with this Chromebox for Meetings by charging a service fee. There's an annual service fee to use this thing.
And that's unique for them, too, is the fact that they're, you know, let's be honest, they don't, with the exception of ads, they don't really know how to make money. I'm serious. They just simply don't.
What are you talking about? They can sell Motorola for $2.something billion.
They bought it for like eight.
Yeah. So that's, you know, it's like Gomez from Adam's Family. You know, buy high and sell low. George, can Google do this? I mean, let's be honest here. I don't, again, love Google. That's what we're using now. It is very user friendly. You think they can pull this off?
I think they can. Josh pointed out something that I think is the crux of it. If they're going to get into this market, the larger conference rooms, the larger user base will be a problem. But if we could keep with and consistently use the huddle space as the model, and that lasts for a good 3 to 5 years, that may be enough to cut off the revenue towards the bigger guys that were trying to still find a spot. Therein has your little struggle. If that concept works from home, in the huddle rooms, that kind of thing, then there's some serious issue there, and Google can probably take over a larger market share than anyone would have anticipated. Other than that, I think it's a great tool, and if they get better video, cool. Like you said, every day we look at this thing, we go, hey, look, new tool.
Yeah,
hey. This is great. We don't have to invest a lot of money in TriCasters and things like that, although that would be nice. But to do this, it's dead simple. And what does it take? Well, a little Google privacy issue, but other than that, it's pretty good.
Little small privacy issue. So, all right.
Well, live out loud, baby, or not at all.
Well, you know, the NSA is watching. My seat at the table with America's CIO. It wasn't my seat, though, because my name's not Yoram Solomon. Yoram sent me a neat little message. Said, hey, by the way, next time I'm on, remind me to tell you about my meeting at the White House. So I was like, dude, cool. So here's what we're going to do. First of all, we're going to ask you about it, Yoram. And then the three of us, four of us, are going to, you know, pick your brain. First of all, you know, how did you get invited to the White House in the first place? How does that happen?
Well, I'm going to guess that they went down very much down a long, long, long list before they got to my name. So I'm not sure what happened to all the people above me. But it was amazing. It was an email which, you know, kind of talks about the White House's approach to technology, you know, the president, the first president to tweet. And but I get an email and it says that you're invited to the White House for a meeting of the Economic Council. And somebody is going to call you to ask for your social security number. And I said, yes, right.
If you're the government, you have it.
Yes, I see where you're going with that. And I thought, you know, I got to hand it to them. Mm-hmm. This is the best ever hoax. But I started checking, and the more I checked, the more this thing kind of looked real. And at some point, I said, you know, I'm going to call the White House and ask them. So I called the White House, and they passed me over to Sam Brown, who's the director of the White House Business Council, who wasn't there. He was late, so I left him a voicemail. And the next day, I'm sitting in a conference, and the phone rings. And I look at the number, and I see that the leader of that conference already looks at me bad because I'm not supposed to take calls. And I'm looking at this number, and I'm thinking, this is the White House number that I called yesterday. And I walked outside, and sure enough, it was him. It was Sam Brown. And he told me, yeah, I got your message. This is a real meeting. I hope you can make it. And it's going to be important. And I walk back to class, and of course, I immediately started talking. And I said, how often in your life do you get a chance to say, I'm sorry, I had to take this call. It was the White House.
I was about to say, I was expecting you to walk out the door going, yes, Mr. President, what can I do for you?
Yes, yes.
But we did go there. It was a group of about 50 people from all around the nation. They held three of those meetings throughout the year, I believe. It was a great event. There were 10 people who sit with the president on a regular basis, advise to him on different topics from immigration. It was a lot about business and economy. And yes, they did try to sell on the Affordable Care Act and about the immigration reform and everything. But it was pretty interesting to hear Stephen Van Roekel, the CIO. I mean, talk about having an IT department with, and he said, you know, he started by saying that he apologized that they have cut, the sequester has cut his budget, so he's now down to $82 billion a year.
That poor guy.
Yes, which is, it's more than we do. But he started with a very interesting story. He said when he goes to buy a house, which kind of led to the article that I was asked to write, when he buys a house, he looks at the bandwidth that's going to be available for that house, which obviously makes him not the decision maker in their family.
Very nice.
Anyway, what did you want to know?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, besides the interesting story, I mean, what did you take away from it? I mean, what was your takeaway from, you know, not only talking with, obviously, you know, the chief information officer of the U.S., but from the other people in the room? I mean, this was a meeting, an economic meeting. It was a technology meeting. What was your biggest takeaway? Was it, you know, did you feel good about the environment or the climate that we're in? Or was it one of those where you go, okay, we've still got some work to do?
Well, it was a combination. Really, when he talked, when the CIO spoke, I waited for him to finish, and then I'm going to raise my hand and ask the first question, which would be, at the risk of sounding too obvious, healthcare.gov. But he did not give me an opportunity to do that, because he went out there and said, all by himself, he said, look, we screwed this up. We didn't do it right. We can't blame anybody other than ourselves, and we need to. We have an amount of consultants now that are helping us make it right. We did it wrong. It's our fault. And the nice thing is, it was more than that. By the way, he's an ex Microsoft person, and I know there's so many things I can say now, but I won't. He took ownership. He had data, and that to me was key. He had data. He knew exactly how many people would get an error message or did get an error message initially, how many get them today, How long did it take to download a page on average? How long does it take today? And so on. So he had a lot of that information, which to me made me feel very comfortable. In some of the other areas, there was a lot of, we're doing great. Economy is recovering. We really like that. At that point, it was 7.0% unemployment, and we're going to kind of ignore the fact that the workforce has reduced because a lot of people are not looking for jobs. There was a lot of the Affordable Care Act. There was the title of that session was The Business Case for the Affordable Care Act, which is why it's so great. And, of course, we're going to ignore the fact that you need all those young people that do not use healthcare to pay. Because otherwise it doesn't make any business case. There was the part about I brought up one of the topics that I was interested in is the and it might interest you, the Jobs Act that is supposedly aimed at creating better access to capital for startup companies, and we deal a lot with startup companies. But I'm not happy with the SEC implementation with rules 506, the what they're proposing to create for crowdfunding, not crowdfunding like Kickstarter where you get something in return, but actually getting equity in return. So they're legislating this. I'm afraid the way they're doing it is a little too paternalistic. It's not going to give access. It's not going to let me decide how I want to invest. So I did bring those up. The White House was or the legislator was great in how they wanted to come up with rules, but the SEC kind of really screwed it up, and I thought that I'll bring it up. And the interesting thing is they followed up with me. I'm still getting emails back and forth on who should be the right person and what are the positions. So I felt they listened. They listened. They took notes. So what will they do with it? We'll see. But they listened and took notes.
Wow, that's impressive. Because usually, I don't get the sense that sometimes they listen. So. But no, that's a very cool thing. That like I said, Yoram sent me the note and said, "Hey, by the way, next time I'm on, let me do this." And yeah, that was very cool. And the guy's a commercial integrator. Had you write the article? So
I have a question about it though. Since Yoram, you brought up the idea of broadband, and that brings up the question of, well, who manages what broadband, what bandwidth can be increased, right? Half of us are saying the government should be at the forefront of it, just like it was at the beginning in inventing the internet, because it was for government and university research, right? And then you've got the Verizons and the AT&T saying, you've structured it, thank you very much, and now we're going to take it over and make it the new broadcast airwaves. Everybody else get the bloody hell off. Is there any kind of discussion that happened around that?
Not so much. The discussion did not happen. It was more, he was a much higher level, and he did not have a lot of time for a question to take our questions compared to the others. In my opinion, that's what I wrote in the article, the whole access, if we go back to DSL, I mean, we would not have made the jump to broadband at DSL if it wasn't for a huge write-off that was made by companies like Covad, Northpoint, Flashcom, and others. And the thing is that I think companies are a lot more careful now. If I go back to AT&T, if you remember those days that when AT&T started selling, AT&T was the first company to sell iPhone right when it came out.
Yeah.
And it wasn't 3 months later until AT&T said, those users of – and by the way, they promised – that you're going to get access, you're going to download videos. That was the essence of why you should move from whoever to AT&T and get an iPhone, because of all the video that you're going to get. And it's not even 3 months later before they say those 10% of iPhone users hog 60% of the bandwidth. And to me, I went, but that's how you sold us.
Yeah.
That's what you sold to us. So,
yeah.
There are going to be a few write-offs in order to get fiber to home, and I think it's going to be a combined model where in some places it's going to be government, in other places it's going to be companies that are doing it with a plan in mind of how they're going to monetize it in the future, and in some cases it's going to be write-offs. We thought we were going to make money on it, we didn't, so we're going to go out of business and we're going to leave the infrastructure behind.
Yoram, you hit on something in the article that I thought was really interesting, which was you talked about, and just now you were talking about how one of the things they brought up was, jobs creation was part of the conference when you were there. what I saw you kind of bringing up was the idea of, well, you know, we're so far behind in the U.S. at only getting 7.4 megabits per second in terms of, you know, we're eighth in the world in terms of our broadband capabilities. It almost sounded like you were screaming, you know, it reminded me of like the Roosevelt New Deal. It's like, okay, well, here's the new tech deal. Okay, so, you know, let's job creation. Let's go lay all this cut. Let's lay all the cable. Let's lay all this to put that out there. It'll do A, job creation, and B, will push us back to the forefront. Is that kind of something that got discussed as a way of bringing all these things together?
It did not. Actually, I did a lot of research to find these numbers, and the only one thing that it brought up was how far back we are compared to the rest of the world, compared to Japan, South Korea, and others. And you know, when you look at, we're behind the Czech Republic. And we're the U.S. And I think that one of the things that happens is that you typically skip a stage, and we're going to skip to the next stage, whether it's fiber or something else, much higher bandwidth. But I think it starts with a metric. And unless we use this metric, and to me, I think that there is a very high correlation between the bandwidth that you have and how advanced your society is. And it's whether it allows doing what we're doing right now, which we couldn't with without the bandwidth that we have. And it goes beyond that. I had a meeting with the city of Richardson, for example, here in North Texas, and they brought up this project that they want to do using a network called Genie that connects very high speed, very low throughput, very low latency. It connects university centers, and they wanted to encourage companies to come up with applications. And I said, you know, no company in the right mind is going to come up with an application for a $4,000 reward when the network is not in place. Put the network in place, put bandwidth in place, and sit back and look at what's going to come up. So it's going to be a combination. I think it is tied to where we are in our education, where we are with our innovation, how much bandwidth we get. And I think that's the metric we need to use.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one thing that I've kind of held for a while is George mentioned it, the fact that it might be some and Yoram and Josh did too, some public, some private. You go back to the cable infrastructure in the U.S. back in the 70s. The U.S. paid for certain groups to be connected to copper. It was so, you know, places where you couldn't get over the air and you couldn't get different services, and it wasn't economically viable for the cable company to lay copper. The government subsidized it, and I think some of that's, you know, I think it's a viable use of our tax dollars, you know.
It's sometimes hard to see the direct correlation. There is an indirect one, but it's a very powerful one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well said.
All right, one last story, guys, and I'll let you get out of here. There's something that from time to time, some of the articles that I'll, or some of the places that I'll go to get articles are, I don't know, unique, at least to me. One of them is the EE Times, which this week had an interesting one. It's stretchable wiring using liquid metal. This is for all of the integrators out there and the folks who pull cable. This sucker can stretch 8 times the original length. For anyone who has ever gone through and pulled out old cable or, you know, I don't know, put in an infrastructure and put in a sound system, Josh, and, you know, for some reason you're losing your subs at some point and you pull out the cable and, oh, hey, there's a splice here, or hey, they pulled too hard on this cable and I'm losing, my resistance has gone through the roof. Josh actually, I'm going to start with you on this. Is this as cool as I think it is, or is this just kind of, you know, yeah, that's just kind of neat?
I think it's really a very cool fact because of, you know, you think about the fact, what's the primary cable that we're pulling at this point in time? It's category cable. Mm-hmm. Everything is, I mean, you look at HD Base T, you look at AVB, you look at Dante, you look at Cobranet, you look at all, I mean, DM cable. Everything is going over category cable, which means we're dealing with some of the most fragile conductors out there in terms of just easily broken. Because especially if you're going solid core CAT cable, now you're looking at stuff that just breaks almost instantaneously. So now if we're able to have a little flex to it, it's like, okay, well, I just pulled this 50, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be long lengths, but I just pulled this 50-foot cable and it's not working. Okay, well, let me test it. Oh, great, one of the leads is dead. So now I've got to pull that back out and pull in a new one, and it's more time consuming in the field. So yeah, it's great. I want to know how much more it's going to cost us per foot of copper, but before I see anything else. But you know, it theoretically could provide us with a much faster installation, a much easier installation if it's widely adopted and cheap.
Oh, cost, whatever. You've got. I'm still waiting.
I wish when it was broken, it just didn't work. But instead, it will work kind of a little bit. It will work just long enough till that, you know, right before the warranty comes out, so it's hard to troubleshoot.
Mm-hmm.
But I have two jobs right now that's exactly what we have to do is pull new cable. I mean, this is definitely an issue out there. Pulling new cable, trying to troubleshoot that is that cable and all that jazz. But this is obviously in a very early stage. This isn't anything that's even being used, right? This isn't being used yet as a cat cable or data cable. This is just technology that could be used that way.
Could be.
It's it'll be shiny.
Yeah, it'll be used as a children's toy first.
Well, let's hope, you know.
Exactly.
Give it to my kids to chew on, so. George, go ahead.
Yeah, no, well, I had a different take on this when we reviewed the article that I never thought about the pulling part, and maybe because I don't pull cables anymore and everything we do is laying across fields or under ramps. But this actually has a property that as you pull it, the longer it gets, the more resistance there is. So that's something to keep in mind that it may not be really what they're shooting for. They're shooting for component level or small product level in which when you manage that resistance, it could actually have an effect, probably a desired effect, we hope, on what the machine or the electronics are doing. The down point, of course, is that it's gallium and iridium, and when those things get out into the natural world, they're not very friendly to most living things.
Pshaw.
There was a story, and if you go on YouTube, you can go find one where they pour some gallium and some iridium on an aluminum can, and it basically turns it into a wet paper towel. Fairly quick order. You know, especially in installations, we did a special on Aviation about crossing Category 5 cables with PVC piping and how it deteriorates both, and that's really not a good thing because most PVC piping would be water piping. That's not good for an installation at all. Just imagine what havoc this could wreck. It's really interesting if you combine it with things like graphene, that new material that they're coming out with that has the electronic capability and what we could possibly come up with those kind of materials combined. I'm really intrigued to see where they go with it.
Well, and actually, George, you just hit on something really interesting coming from the live sound perspective of if the resistance is going to change, okay, great. Well, that can dictate the distance that you can place your amplifiers from your speakers if you're doing passive resistance. So, okay, well, I know my cable has to provide this resistance, so I'm going to stretch it out to exactly this distance and then clamp it down.
Yep.
So you're not going to get the varied resistance that you could potentially get as a cable, you know, as things change.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if there's a difference between using it in the macro and the micro scale and whether or not they can do both. It'd be really intriguing to see.
By the way, I think, first of all, George, thank you for now I have a new way of creating a wet paper towel.
I wouldn't want to use it, mind you. It's sort of the Sochi, bad for face water. But
yes, by the way, it's a lot better than putting plutonium in the water.
Well,
and one thing that we're all kind of missing is those flexible wires. I mean, you can pull them like rubber. I mean, what happens with the connector and one end gives up and shoots in your face from 50 feet of that? Think about that.
Mm-hmm.
But to be more serious, this is basic research, and there are going to be plenty of applications. And I think we need to sometimes thank people who do basic research, whether they're universities, consortia, with billions of dollars spent into them without knowing exactly how you're going to make money off of it. But once they do, all of a sudden the applications come out. I can think of a myriad of applications, whether initially military, later we're talking about the AV industry, but a whole lot of, if you think of laptops and other things where today you're struggling with the wires that go through the hinge. There are plenty of applications. I don't think we're going to suffer from applications. The cost is going to come down as we go through experience curve, as we learn how to manufacture those in a better way. But we have to every now and then stop and give thanks to those who do basic research and do come up with things that enable applications that couldn't be done before.
Hallelujah, brother. Yeah. I got to tell you, hallelujah, because next time I hear somebody complain that they gave $1 million for bovine pheromone research or something similar, They have no idea that the possibilities down the road could turn into something completely different but so universally beneficial.
Even if you don't know what it is right now.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. That's the entire, almost the entire story of the space program. I mean, how many, we have no idea how many technologies and advances that we've all benefited from. And
well, we do. Tang, Velcro.
Oh, jeez. Yes, those two things, George.
And let's not forget all the things the aliens provided us in their visit.
Yes.
Of course.
He provided us with, what's that guy's last name? The guy that... Oh, never mind.
You know, suddenly I just want to hear that guy in, was it Ancient Aliens with the hair that stands up aliens. Like this? I want to hear him say about that.
Aliens. Regardless of what it is, explanation is aliens. So, all right. Before we go any further, thank you all so much. With us is the guy that spent the night in jail, but my favorite doctor, Dr. Yoram Solomon, Vice President of Corporate Strategy at Penview. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
How can people get a hold of you or Penview or whatever if they want to get a hold of you?
Tweet me at Yoram. That's it. Y-O-R-A-M. At Yoram.
All right. Also with us, Josh Strago. Josh is the project manager for ICS. Also a prolific writer. I think you said at one point you had 4 articles at different publications this week. So
yeah.
Thank you.
It's been busy. Thank you very much for having me.
How can people get a hold of you or find you?
Twitter at JSRAGO. You can find me on my website at Sound Reason. You can find me on the Red Band website. Right now, you can find me offering a critique of the Crystal Ball at Rave. And actually, brand new this week, this is my big announcement, is I'm officially part of the Infocom All Voices blog now.
Oh, very good. Congratulations.
Congrats.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. And also with us is Heather Sidorowitz. Heather is the new Presidente of Southtown Audio Video. Congratulations again, ma'am.
Thank you very much, sir.
And how can people find you?
I am on Twitter. I am tech_chi, C-H-I. Tech Chi is in balance with technology. You can find me on Residential Systems. I blog weekly for them. And our company website is www.southtownav.com.
Very good. Last but not least, George Tucker, engineering coordinator for World Stage, and my right-hand man. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Where can people find you?
If you're looking for me, yeah. If it's on social media, Tucker Twos. I'm probably there. I mean, I respond to all of them, but I'm there. I also write for some of the
EH
pubs.
Popular. That's impressive.
He is that popular.
I'll respond.
I'm obsessive compulsive about getting onto social media sites, and then I let half of them die. But hey.
just can't be bothered anymore.
Well, you know, if they're not generating. Look, I just got a friend request from Path. I was like,
Path?
Path.
I thought Path.
I think Johnny Mota's the only guy I know that still uses that.
Yeah, Johnny Mota and Leo Laporte, that's it.
That's about Leo. It, yes. But you can also find my writings on some of the EHPub periodicals. That's Commercial Integrator and Corporate Tech Decisions.
Yeah, very cool.
As well as here.
As well as here. Yeah, absolutely. Don't follow me if it's TDL, right? But go by the website if you would, please. AVNation.TV. AVNation.TV. George and my buddy Matt Scott have done an awful lot of really good work on the website. It's still being tweaked, but very, very impressed with what they've done. You'll find this program as well as a host of others. We've done a recent Live, which is George's live staging and event. EdTech, which is our education show, where they're getting ready to do a new AV Social, which is social media and marketing, and a host of others. AVNation.TV, AVNation.TV. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for watching. This has been AV Week.